In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're pleased to bring you a special summer offer from our sister magazines. You can try 3 issues of BBC History Magazine or BBC History Revealed for just £5. That's a saving of up to 72% off the shop price. Plus, you'll receive free UK delivery on each issue. To find out more and take advantage of this offer, visit our official online store, buysubscriptions.com/podcast2021. If you're based in the US, you also won't miss out. You can try 3 issues for just $9.95, saving a huge 70%. For more details, visit buysubscriptions.com/podcast2021. Please be aware that both these offers end on the 31st of August 2021. And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. The history of land ownership in England is a contested one. A story of hard-fought battles over access to landscapes and resources, and debates over whether they should belong to the many or be accessed only by a privileged few. It's a history that writer Nick Hayes looks at in The Book of Trespass, which has just come out in paperback. I put a call into Nick on his houseboat to find out more. Thanks very much for joining me today, Nick.
Thanks so much for having us. I appreciate it.
Let's talk about your book, Book of Trespass. So it's a journey through stories of land possession, trespass, enclosure, dispossession, the public right to land, really. So what first drew you to this subject? What was it that intrigued you about the idea of trespass and its history?
Well, the book begins with a sort of lesser known story about the Kinder Trespass, like the largest, most famous trespass in England. It starts with a guy that was just going for a walk anyway, just running into this kind of angsty, political, aggressive battle between 400 kids from the surrounding, you know, Manchester, Sheffield, Derby, the Duke of Devonshire's gamekeepers. I was drawn to that story because that kind of felt like me. I was trespassing from an early age as someone that really didn't know the political implications, even the law. It didn't feel like I was doing anything wrong. My job at the moment is an illustrator, and just ever since I was a kid, I used to take a sketchbook with me, walk the paths around my home, and if a fallen oak tree happened to be 20 yards off the path, and if the perspective of it was much better from, you know, the stump just in front of it rather than behind the barbed wire, I'd just go to draw it. And I guess incrementally as you're met with, this kind of anything between outrage to sheer aggression of the representatives of the landowner, you start to think it's all a little incongruous to what I'm actually doing. So what is that about, and where does their anger come from, and am I actually doing anything wrong? You know, as much as anything, I wanted to see, you know, like, how bad is this?
Well, that's a good question. How bad is this? In the English context, because that's kind of what we're talking about here, how is trespass defined, and how has it been defined over time?
Well, in England, it's defined under the law of tort, which constitutes damage to the personhood of the landowner. So English law fails to recognise any issues such as context or the scale of the property that you're trespassing in, and basically lumps everything together as if it is just a home invasion. Whereas just over the border in Scotland, or in Norway or Sweden or Estonia, it's defined in a completely different way, that the public have rights of access just so long as they're not causing any damage to the property. In England, however, just you being there is literally defined as damage, which is something they call in legal circles a legal fiction, but more commonly is known just rubbish.
So when you started digging into this, the background of this story, the history of it really, what kind of story did you uncover?
One of dispossession of the working class people of England, one of exploitation of the land, one of they're called perquisites, but they're basically the perks, what the sort of stuff you get on top of owning the land, is defined in Latin, in the legal term is jus abutendi, the right to destroy. It's an untold story of English history. It's the story of English history is about the lords and the aristocrats that owned our land, but never does anyone tell you exactly where they got that land or the kind of methods they used to do it. Highclere Castle is a very good example, where Downton Abbey, the popular TV show, was filmed. To own the 6,000 acres of land, the lord of the time literally dispossessed the village of Highclere that was there in the first place. And that story is told all over England. There's not an inch of land in England that hasn't at some point been contested, not from the commoners, who were the people that used the land, for winter fuel or to graze their animals. They never owned the place. But before William the Conqueror, they had the right to use it because it was recognized that their lives depended on being able to, autonomous, self-subsistent. You could be poor in those days, but you didn't have to be destitute because you were able to rely upon your access rights to the land to gain the bare necessities.
So what are some of the milestones in that story, the story of how England essentially became privatized?
Well, William the Conqueror, number one. Every land rights activist seems to have a real bee in their bonnet about this king that came over 1,000 years ago. What he did was completely rejig our relationship to the land. The word forest is a word that comes from the Latin forest, meaning outside of. And it's got nothing to do with trees as we kind of associate it with it now. What it really means is that it was a new designation brought in by William the Conqueror that meant it was outside of common law. So common law allowed people, as I said, to, you know, collect their wood or to feed their animals. And under heavy regulations of fellow commoners, you know, the whole premise of common land is that you don't own it, you're borrowing it off your grandchildren. Sustainability was not a word so much then, but definitely part of the ethic. And it's certainly no new thing. So William the Conqueror came over and just enclosed about a fifth of England and said, this is outside of common law. Anyone that lives within these fences will be evicted. And anyone that lives on the outside and uses them automatically has their rights taken away. Because he just wanted these areas to be breeding grounds for deer, which was basically the focus of his recreational activity. Him and his barons liked to go hunting. Statute of Merton in the 14th century, you know, it kind of nationalized enclosure and like took it from, basically formalized it into something that barons or nobles could use as a law. They could quote this law to be able to go and enclose land. Then the Tudor period saw land ownership itself become a kind of profession. It was a way of making money. And all of the sort of subsidiary professions around it, you know, the lawyers and the surveyors and all of that. And then the Georgian era was by far my favorite era of enclosure. That's really when we saw the rivers through industrialization, you know, the rivers being taken out of bounds for the public, simply because the flow, the current of the river was the power that drove the initial steps of the Industrial Revolution. So weirs were put in, you know, canals, like rivers were canalized, and the public's lost their right to swim or to fish or to experience the rivers from that period on, basically. And there's kind of a myth that enclosure is a thing of the past, but it's happening today in cities. We see privately owned public spaces, but we also see it even just most recently in lockdown, people blocking up rights of way. You know, one of the most common forms of enclosure is to obliterate the natural resource altogether. You know, you're enclosed from using it because it doesn't exist anymore. But the issue here is that so much of that has already happened that we've forgotten even, you know, the mental health, the physical health benefits of, say, swimming in particular. So we don't go to the rivers because we've forgotten them as a resource. They've been fenced off for decades, if not centuries. And that's the real, you know, that's the real wall that blocks us from accessing nature, is long before we've ever got to the barbed wire that physically restricts us from nature. It's just we've forgotten it as an option.
So looking backwards, what are some of the biggest battles over some of these issues that you've seen through history, the contests over land possession and trespass?
Well, actually, it's when you can sort of tell that enclosure finally worked, when protest in effect dropped its reference to land rights towards the end of the Georgian era. Before then, anything from the Peasants' Revolt, the Midlands Revolt, the Pilgrimage of Grace, protests that weren't ostensibly about land rights and access to land and enclosure, actually all had as part of their criteria for change better access to the land, or like a reversing of enclosure. But by the time the Industrial Revolution took hold, it's almost like the focus of protest suddenly had to change from the fundamental right that we have to self-subsistence and autonomy. All of a sudden, that was thrown out of the window and we all became wage slaves. So now we start arguing about how much we get paid and how unfair it is that we have to work through the weekends. You have to start campaigning for, you know, sick pay and welfare state protection kind of thing. So around the Georgian era was the kind of caesura where all protest in effect gave up trying to tell the establishment that access to the land was our access to our sort of autonomous ability to survive. And then, unfortunately it changed. But But big examples, Greenham Common was all about the way it played out. Ostensibly, it was about nuclear war. You know, there were warheads that were brought by Reagan into England, which turned Newbury, which is the town I grew up next to, as kind of like number one on the hit list for the Kremlin all of a sudden. But that obviously turned into, when men were banned from the camp, that turned into a protest that was sort of promoting feminist values. But then the way the council tried to evict them, the argument turned very quickly to land rights. And Michael Heseltine was like, happily for a feminist protest, was deemed to be acting ultra vires, is the legal term, like essentially, like literally translated as beyond his manhood. He was overstepping his rights of power to evict these people because they were on common land. And that is what common land used to mean. You had rights to be there. And so you couldn't be evicted, no matter how much of a thorn in the side you were to the military and to the, you know, to the government at the time.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Well, I think that if you've done your research, if you've looked up on Historic England, or you've, you know, read the book about the area kind of thing, there's not a scrap of land in England that isn't like rooted in history.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You mentioned at the start of the conversation the Kinder Scout trespass, and that's the anecdote really that you opened the book with. Why was that, you know, so important that you wanted to open the book with it? And did it have a legacy, or was it a flash in the pan, really?
Both is the answer. Like 24th of April, 1932, there's something about the legacy of Kinder Trespass that has become sepia-toned. It's got this sort of patina of respectability on it now, which is certainly very useful for the modern day land rights campaigner. The kind of people that were saying these kids, or the kind of newspapers and establishments who were saying that these kids are commie hooligans, they've set back the advance of land rights by, you know, 10-20 years, they don't know what they're doing, they're ignorant, all of those people now celebrate the Kinder Trespass, kind of because it's long enough ago to go, isn't it wonderful? But of course, when fracking protesters up in Preston do exactly the same thing, they're vilified. Or when XR take to the streets, they're called uncooperative crusties. The Kinder Trespass itself was 400 kids going for a walk along one of the very, very rare paths of or legal rights of way that they had up in Bleaklow at the time. They were sick of basically every weekend, hundreds, thousands of people would come to Bleaklow just to catch a breath of fresh air, because this was, you know, the area surrounded by some of the most industrialized cities at the time in the north. There was like something like 2 miles of footpath that they could that they were legally allowed to, and yet all of this other land that was reserved for grouse shooting. In the end, they just strayed about 400 yards off the path. 6 of them were convicted and put in prison for a breach of the peace. There was a sort of brief flurry of violence when the gamekeepers started to fight with some of the kids. And that was it. The year after, those numbers had multiplied by tenfold. You know, people, like in 1890, the Winter Hill Trespass was 10,000 people. But there is something about the Kinder Trespass that has sort of caught the imagination of people. The danger of that, of course, is that people tend to, it's a Gustav Mahler quote about folk music, actually, but it's, you know, folk music is tending the flame, not worshipping the ashes. And certainly there is a sort of older socialist mindset that kind of venerates the Kinder Trespass rather than kind of repeating it.
I wonder if you could tell us about some of the most notable figures in the fight for common land or public rights to land.
Well, it's a good question. There are certainly names that history has recorded. Captain Pouch is a almost legendary figure from the Midlands Revolt in 1607. He was sort of an itinerant tinker, much like Paul Revere, who kind of alerted the local Americans to the English invasion. Simply, he had just an itinerant's knowledge of the local communities, and he'd won their respect. So he was able to go and rally the troops for a revolt that involved thousands of people across various towns in the Midlands, uprising against enclosure, which was particularly savage in the early 1600s around Northampton and that kind of area. But really the ones that interest me, there was King John of these riots in the 1700s were called the Black Riots, because the people that did them, they basically like modern Robin Hood style, but slightly less swashbuckling and a little more violent, went into the deer parks that they'd only recently been excluded from and just basically shot all the deer. Didn't take them home. It was a brutal message of revenge, almost like just outrage. But they sort of branched out into people that were unfairly accused or that were on their way to the gallows. They would rescue them and sort of threaten the magistrates if they considered that actually justice wasn't being done here. But all of these threats and all of these acts were done under the name King John. And King John was a fictitious character that was kind of the kind of personification of the uprising. Similarly, I think it was Susan that the Greenham women signed all of their letters to the council. They said, kind regards, or, please stop removing our standpipe for our water and our hygiene. Kind regards, Susan. And what I love about this is that, conventional history wants to put either the blame or the accolade onto, this kind of like pinnacle of a hierarchy. There's always a leader. There's always someone with the grand master plan who has the charisma of Jesus to sort of gather people together. And the rest of, the thousands of people involved with it are kind of just sheep to the herd. With land rights, it's a commoners movement. Every movement has thousands of people that are doing all of the work. And yet, understandably, the narrative or the media or the historical account of it needs to basically, either vilify or turn into a hero, one or two people kind of thing. So I like Susan and King John because they kind of...
They're everybody.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Something else that I wanted to ask you about that you look at in the book is the idea of vagrancy, attitudes towards people moving through land without a fixed abode. How have feelings about that changed over time? Because it's always been quite a potent issue, hasn't it?
No, it completely has. Vagrancy, back in the day, the sort of 1100s, when vagrancy acts started to be brought in by the various kings, vagrancy was autonomy. If, your local boss or your landowner wasn't paying you what you thought was just dessert for the labor that you put in, you had the right to just go and look for work elsewhere. And certainly after the plague, when about a third of the English workforce were just dead, there was suddenly the power swung from the employers, from the landowners to the labourers. They were able to pick and choose where they went. So there was a whole new spate of vagrancy acts that was just banning people from moving. And then you get to, who Henry VIII mislabeled as the Egyptians, which has become shortened to gypsies. They were actually from Rajasthan, nomadic people from Rajasthan, which in itself tells you a lot about state projection and how little investigation was done into the culture and the mindset of the people. I got fascinated with it researching in the book. Then it starts to get into something a bit more psychological, a bit more subconscious. This fear of motion as opposed to the sort of comfortable acceptance of rootedness. Crucially, like many of the acts, allowed people not to be hanged or not to have ears bored through or holes bored through their ears or put in the stocks or have V for vagabond branded on their chest. If crucially, they just gave up their traveling lifestyle. Vagrancy acts. There's a vagrancy act that was brought in the Georgian era that's still in place today. And it basically allows people to be arrested for taking food from bins or rough sleeping. But there is a prejudice and a deep set fear of people who wander because fundamentally they can't be controlled.
What are some of the most magical places that you were able to visit that had a real kind of sense of history to them when you were working on the book?
Well, I think that if you've done your research, if you've looked up on Historic England or you've, you know, read the book about the area kind of thing, there's not a scrap of land in England that isn't like rooted in history, social history, ecological history, geologic, you know, when we say land, we're actually incorporating so many different kind of notions with it. We don't just mean the topography or the flora and the fauna. We mean the history of it. And so for me, a large part of all of that was the folk legends that kind of surrounded the place. And for that reason, I'd have to say Home Park outside Windsor Castle. Basically, up until 1847, it was a public park, 400 acres. There was a pub in it, Frogmore Inn. And then because Prince Albert decided he wanted to go bathing in the nude in the Thames, they decided to wall it off. And so it's an example of a park that was kind of enclosed as per normal, no big deal. But the thing is, there's a tree in it that is kind of venerated in Shakespeare's The Merry Wives of Windsor that is attached to a very local legend of a guy called or a sort of a gamekeeper turned poacher called Herne the Hunter, who wears, you know, horns upon his head. And it's kind of this local Berkshire iteration of that old horned god, that kind of Bacchus or Kernanos kind of thing. And I love the story. The story is about wildness over trimmed lawns. It's about the profusion and kind of, you know, sexuality almost of nature, that kind of spring bursting forth over the kind of sterile sort of authoritarianism of a kind of superstructure such as Windsor Castle over the top of it. But key to this whole story is that it's now a criminal act punishable with a year in prison to even, you know, by the laws of trespass, to even place your finger upon that ground. And so on my kayak many times, like it basically borders the Thames River, and it's probably about 500 yards down a tree-lined avenue that is where this tree that commemorates Herne the Hunter is. And for the last chapter of the book, it's kind of like the Italian job. Do I, don't I go to visit the tree? I understand it's all a bit woo-wah, this sort of believing in or just having an enthusiasm for those old kind of pagan myths. But for me, they are the kind of alternative commoner's story of relating to the land. They're the commoner's version of the landowner's yield book, you know, how much the land is worth, what, you know, how much corn or livestock you were able to, you know, get profit on. These are the stories that talk about our kind of spectral, kind of spiritual, phenomenological, if that's even the right way of saying it, experience of the land that has almost entirely been obliterated with enclosure and the acceptance of private property over public rights of access kind of thing. So I could bang on. We'll do another podcast about Herne the Hunter because he's just cool.
It's an incredible, surreal story, isn't it? So my final question, I feel like has been running throughout this whole conversation, but it's just about how all these centuries of history take us to the place where we're at today. Where can we see the legacy of all this contested history in England today?
In our acceptance of it, I think. If you went and put up razor wire around the lakes in Finland right now, there would be a national outcry. If you told Scottish wild swimmers that they were no longer allowed in 97% of the rivers, which is the statistic for England, there would be, again, outrage. Because the people that are connected to nature know just how valuable it is to their mental health and their physical health. But this is a story of kind of incremental acceptance. It's like the frog boiling in the pan kind of thing. Like, you know, they've been turning the heat up on our exclusion from nature for 1,000 years to the point where we just can't feel it. The NHS Forest estimates last year we spent £8.2 billion on the repercussions, medicating, trying to solve the repercussions of our sedentary lifestyles. And the thing is, wild swimming, you don't even need swimming trunks. Like, there's it's cheap. It's and it brings so much to people. So we need to start looking at access to land, not as some kind of socialist chop off the aristocrat's head and bung it on a stick kind of victory. We need to look at it as the privatization of healthcare. But let's give people the right to self-medicate in a way by, you know, controlling obesity or chronic pulmonary heart disease or anxiety or depression or PTSD, you know, post-traumatic stress. Like, these are things that science has proven their symptoms can be alleviated through regular access to nature. The problem is, at the moment, with only 8% of England being available for a right to roam, like, those places are so far away from the general population that they're basically relegated, or nature, the experience of nature is relegated to a kind of lifestyle holiday Instagram post for those that can afford it. And we could just be such a healthier nation if we were just allowed to swim in the rivers that are near us.
That was Nick Hayes. The Book of Trespass, Crossing the Lines That Divide Us, is out in paperback now, published by Bloomsbury. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.